Natural Living with Gary Null, exploring the nature and politics of medicine, health, nutrition, and the environment. And now your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to our program. A continuation of my ongoing, in-depth, special investigative report on AIDS, A Second Opinion. Providing you with different information than hitherto you have been given, allowing you to hopefully, after careful examination of the facts that I'm presenting, to reevaluate your position on AIDS. I have in my program tried to take each one of the primary arguments and to dissect it and to see, does this at this point withhold or give us more information to make a decision from? Unfortunately, I believe that the mainstream media has not been as responsible as it should be in challenging some of the prevailing view, but rather parroting these uncritically, that whatever they're told by the CDC or other organizations, they simply accept as a truism. But what if what we've learned about AIDS is wrong? I want to take you further in our dialogue that I began on our last program about the nature of the sexual transmissibility of AIDS, and then go on from there into other areas that I believe that we have not carefully examined enough. What I am presenting are the viewpoints of many dissidents, leading scientists, and physicians, and activists who have taken the time to do what others have not. They have stopped and said, if you're telling us that HIV is primarily or exclusively transmitted by sex, then let's just look at the evidence to see whether or not it is continued to be and should be supported. Or if, as some believe, that there are gaps, enormous gaps in the logic, that we should revise our feelings on this. I gave you more than 40 individuals in my last program in the series who challenged this, and that's only the tip of the iceberg. I want to take it a little further now. Let's get back to Callan's thoughts on why having multiple sexual partners led to disease proclivities. For one, in Callan's view, it wasn't just a matter of having too much sex, but rather for the passive partner, having sex involved repeated exposures to secretions from many different partners. Add to that the hazard from the cumulative effects of drugs used habitually to drive his sexual merry-go-round, and that they had concentrated among themselves just about every sexually transmitted microbe available. They were a diseased group, repeatedly infecting one another. And keep in mind, among the 100 original men diagnosed with AIDS, all 100 were shown to have had over 1,160 different sexual partners per person, and some of those individuals had over 10,000 partners because they belonged to what was considered the 10,000 Club, a young male who could claim that they had 10,000 partners, and how many of those individuals had multiple sexually transmitted diseases. To find this out, I went to the sex clubs. I spent months, virtually every night, generally starting around 8 or 9 o'clock, going in New York City to the sex clubs down on Christopher Street, and there's a small, about 3-block square area where all the activity was really happening. I would see people, and it was all done in the open. People pride themselves on their liberation. They felt that this was a merit badge they had earned because of having suffered the abuse of a moralistic society that judged them for just being gay. And they now had found a freedom to express themselves. It was expressed in the streets, and people would stay away from that area, heterosexuals in particular, because this was their area, and they defended it. And they defended their right to have as many sexual partners as they wished. And if you didn't like it, then look the other way. And you didn't have to look very far, because even when you looked the other way, there were a series of trucks. And across the street, across the West Side Highway, across from Christopher Street, there was a parking area where big commercial trucks would park at night. every one of those trucks, sometimes as many as 30 or 40 trucks, these are big trucks, like a moving van, they would have their doors open and you would see thousands of cigarettes as you stood across the street. And I marvel looking at this, little tiny like sparkles in all these trucks. And there would be a procession of men lined up going into these trucks. And they would go in and have the sex and exit the truck. And when you would go over the truck, you would not hear anything. You would hear sometimes the moans of an orgasm, but you would not hear people talking. They would have had their sex. And then when I would say, well, how many times you do this in a night? Oh, 20, 30 times. And I thought, well, as a healthy heterosexual, I would find it very difficult to have sex 5 times a night, let alone 20 or 30. How do you do it? And they would show you all the ampules, or they would show you the angel dust, but almost every single person had pockets full of poppers, amyl nitrate. And they would take the amyl nitrate, and they would break an amyl nitrate under their nose and inhale it, and they would get that rush. And the rush would give them that sense of being able to sustain the orgasm. And they would take a lot of the drugs. And one of the men, there was one truck that was specific for fisting. And you went over there because that's where the action was. Then across the street, there were some bars. And in the bars, depending upon what type of specific sex you wanted, you would go to that particular bar. And there was the rough sex bar, where everyone in there was in leather and kind of like a, looked like a, almost like a tough group of cyclists. And there was a lot of the bondage. And you saw all kinds of things. Things that the average researcher didn't want to acknowledge was a part of the AIDS problem. The scientists at those nice universities weren't coming out of their ivory towers and coming down to where I was day after day, month after month, year in and year out, interviewing, talking, because how can you find out about something unless you go out and see it? If you talk with a monogamous heterosexual journalist, and they're going to give you the idea that AIDS is a virus and that we're all equally susceptible and that you must practice safe sex, and that if you don't, you're going to get it, and then if you do, then you're going to have to take HIV antivirals. And then you ask them, well, how many healthy homosexuals do you know who have AIDS with no other risk factors except for the fact that they're gay? And if they were honest, the answer is none. And what do you see when you see an immune system of a young man that is spending the entire night having as much sex as they can, and they've been doing for 2 to 3 years, and they're smoking, and they're drinking, and they're taking handfuls of antibiotics, and virtually everyone there had antibiotics. Now, being in the medical sciences, and being a research scientist, and being with the Institute of Applied Biology, and counseling drug addicts through Trafalgar Hospital, where we were associated, and alcoholics on a daily basis, I can tell you I saw an awful lot of tagged toes on 18 and 19-year-olds who had OD'd or died of massive shock and trauma and cirrhosis of the liver, all forms of disease and hepatitis, and they were young and they were dead, or they were young and they were in counseling and they were burned out and could have died. And their immune systems were just destroyed. Look at the liver of an alcoholic. Look at how much shorter the lifespan is. Look at the infections they come down with. Look at the incidence of other diseases that are associated with defects in the immune system. And then look carefully and very closely, and don't allow your political or religious or social biases to prejudice what you're willing to look at, because what you're not willing to look at will be part of the missing picture that would have given you a more honest determination that hey, there's something going on here that we haven't been honest about, we haven't been looking at. And so I was just doing what I felt a responsible investigator had to do. I never once did I meet another journalist, not once, ever, who was there doing the work I was doing. Yet they were writing with such certainty from the New York Times and on shows, and I would sit just appalled at the temerity and the arrogance of their position. They were making proclamations that this disease scourge would infect heterosexual populations and everybody should be tested, and they didn't connect the antibiotics that they could get easily. You wanted any drug at all, you could go to one of the trucks and there would be card tables set up at night. Card tables would be there from 6 o'clock. And what was of interest is how many times I saw the police drive by, but were not stopping. Any form of drug you wanted, heroin, crack cocaine, methamphetamine, anything at all, it was there. In the open, this wasn't hidden, because, quote, this is our turf. We do what we want here. I heard that so many times, it's like a mantra. Stay out of our way. We're enjoying ourselves. And indeed, they enjoyed themselves. They just didn't anticipate the downside of all that they were doing. Too much of a good thing? Far too much. And you would have people, there was one school teacher, one principal that I decided, with his permission, that I would follow his health to see what the consequence would be. His name was Stanley. And Stanley, in the daytime, was a principal in a high school in the Bronx. And he was about 43 when the sexual liberation had occurred. Until that time, he rarely had sex. He mainly masturbated. He would masturbate 5 or 6 or 7 times a day. Then when after the Stonewall occurred and after the sexual liberation within the gay community started and the disco scene came out, sex by Stanley became different. He no longer would masturbate 7 times a day. He would go to the clubs and to the bars. And there was one gay club in particular in New York that had multiple rooms. And he would go and see who was in the room, and it was all kind of quiet. There'd be disco music in the background, and Stanley would be walking room to room. And he would see who he liked, and then he'd go in and have sex with him. And he would generally have receptive intercourse, where he would receive the intercourse, masturbate, be finished. And he said that, I said, well, how can you actually, when you ejaculate, do you actually have any sperm? He said, no. He said, it's all used up about the first time, and certainly by the second time. He said, it's just a dry climax. And Stanley used amine nitrate. Sometimes 15 times I saw him in one night come out and had popped, used a popper. He didn't take the other drugs, and he didn't smoke, and he didn't drink. It was mainly anal sex and amine nitrate. 4 years later, and it took 4 years, Stanley had 3 of the opportunistic infections, and he was on massive amounts of antibiotics. Massive. He was diagnosed as later with full-blown AIDS, and it was at that point that he asked me, would I help him with the protocol, and I did, and I put him on a holistic protocol, and he went on to live another almost 15 years. And he died of a heart attack in his, he was in his early 60s. And he had given up the fast track gay life. That was one example, but he was not the only example. There were others that I followed. And with their permission, with in-depth interviews with him. And yet, if someone asked him, Stanley, do you have a lot of sex? He said no, because he was terribly afraid that his position within his work environment would have been jeopardized. It would not have been obvious to anyone that Stanley was gay. For all intents and purposes, he looked like an average heterosexual in his behavior, his mannerisms. Not true with a lot. A lot really prided themselves in their differences, but also in their appetites for drugs and sex. And most of them did the drugs in order to feel a part of the scene. You couldn't walk into one of those clubs without being handed drugs. Drugs were everywhere. You didn't have to buy any. They'd give them to you. And nobody looked at the scientific literature. And I remember one night bringing down some articles, some abstracts, some scientific literatures on what happens to your immune system when you take amyl nitrate? And I gave some of the guys that I had seen and, you know, become friendly with, and I said, take a look at this. And I showed them the articles, and they go, okay. And then turn right around, they didn't care. And I said, but you see, taking amyl nitrate poppers will create the very conditions that will destroy the immune system more than anything else. Kaposi sarcoma is directly related to amyl nitrate use. And also, it destroys the immune system. Nobody seemed to look at this. Nobody wanted to know this. Nobody wanted to take responsibility that they could be causing their own illnesses. And virtually everyone had multiple episodes with hepatitis. And everybody's looking for the next experimental vaccine. So between the antibiotic use and the multiple sexually transmitted diseases, especially hepatitis, and the depression of the immune system with alcohol, smoking, drugs, and malnutrition, what is amazing to me is that the AIDS incidence was not higher and didn't become more, people didn't become aware of it sooner. I was simply aware of it because I was seeing it at the hospital each day and at the institute before the popular press caught on. That just gives you a little framework that I'm coming from this whole picture from having put thousands upon thousands upon thousands of hours into researching at every level. And again, during this entire time, did I ever hear about or see anyone from the CDC, the National Cancer Institute? No. Any mainstream journalist? Never. Nope. So that led to a very limited perspective, I felt, in them making the determinants that they did. Now let's continue on. For Colin, in his view, it wasn't just a matter of having too much sex, rather for the passive party, having sex involved repeated exposures to secretions from many different partners. Add to that the hazards from the cumulative effect of drugs used habitually to drive the sexual merry-go-round, and that they had concentrated among themselves just about every sexually transmitted microbe, and then you understand in the context that he was talking. We see then that on this fuller explanation, which leads us back to Colin's remarks, the fast lane thesis does not rest solely on sexual behavior, but also on the behavior linked to the use of drugs. In fact, I'll give you a little aside. Because I counseled him, I will not use his name. I've never divulged the identity of any of the celebrities I've counseled, and I've counseled a lot of celebrities. I mean, a lot. And one of the reasons that I counsel them is because I counsel them in private. Not even my secretary knows their names. And when I help them detoxify them from whatever it is, sometimes these are career savers, meaning, give you just a hypothetical here, but not far off. A very famous movie star, one of the big ones, that, you know, the $20 million picture, is diagnosed with a very serious illness. No one knows it yet. And he knows that if he wants to get into a film, the film has to be bonded. And the bonding company is not going to give you insurance to finish the film, complete the film, if they know you have a very serious illness. In fact, in Hollywood, that's a kiss of death. Everybody will say they're concerned, but most are not going to be that interested in seeing your career go much a whole lot further. It's a very me-first kind of concept. Your close friends, yes. Those who are dependent upon you, yes. Those who might appreciate you, yes. But an awful lot of people be only too happy to see that one less person standing in line to my trying to get successful. And this person told me this. This was his words. I work with him, and over a period of time, he got his health back completely. Hence, when he did his test, he was fine. No one in the world except he and I, and one other person close to him, knows that he was very sick and his career would have been over. But when I'm counseling these celebrities, they frequently give me insights and tell me about things, and I ask them to be very honest, and they are. And you see that many of the things that we think about them, the public doesn't know. Like, the public doesn't know if someone's a drinker, and it's not good for their image, then you're in all likelihood, unless they do something really foolish, you're never going to know that maybe their sickness came from their drinking or drugs, unless it's something very obvious like a Robert Downey Jr., where the world knows his story, it knows his troubles and plights. But what about all the other people that haven't ended up in rehab that don't want that image upon them or their families? What about the people who fear this kind of disclosure? So we never know the whole story until we're working with someone. And then that story tends to come out. And I'm thinking about how many times back in the 1970s, when the disco scene was hot, and we would hear of a well-known person coming down with AIDS, and we'd say, well, but, you know, they had no risk factors, just, I guess, you know, it just happens to people. Well, behind the scenes, I was working with some of those people, and I can tell you, there were risk factors. What their publicists were telling the American press, and what I heard from their own mouth, I said, you got to be honest with me. You know, tell me what you've been doing that might have created your illness. And then they deny it, then you start pulling it out. And then after a while, you start seeing that it was the fast track. It was the drugs, repeated sexual transmitted diseases. Not good for someone who's in a public position where the public buying your product is a part of them respecting your image. And so all that was swept carefully under the carpet. So for those journalists and those activists who said, well, there are cases of people, and they'll cite a few of those people, they didn't counsel those people. They didn't know them. I have. There is a difference. We see then that on this fuller explanation, which leads back to his original remarks, the fast track really, really is what we should be paying attention to. Moreover, beyond what was said about rectal damage, which it would seem could occur as frequently in a monogamous relationship, given the same amount of intercourse, is the danger of contracting sexually transmitted diseases, a danger that increases with the number of contacts. This last point can be backed up by more analytical research. A Denver study found that on an average bathhouse patron risks a 33% risk of walking out with syphilis or gonorrhea for each visit with each individual partner. Now then put that in perspective of people who had 7 days a week, 10 to 20 partners per night. Another study showed that 94% of sexually active male homosexuals have been infected at one point with CMV, cytomegalovirus, which is a sexually transmitted disease, while 7% tested at a venereal disease clinic were actively infected with virus present in their semen. Colodin goes so far as to argue that based upon the statistics of rates of infection, that number of partners by itself has minimal influence on spread of the virus, as contrasted to the influence of debilitating sexually transmitted diseases. In other words, if a gay male was a member of the 10,000 club but had never been infected with any sexually transmitted disease, his chance of contracting AIDS would be low, as the most low libidoed monogamous man. The danger of AIDS comes rather from both sexually transmitted diseases and antibiotics used to get rid of them, and sexual drugs used to enhance the sexual activity. Promiscuity, Culloden writes, is directly associated with antibiotic treatments and the permanent prophylaxis of sexually transmitted diseases. It's worth noting that where the first theory we investigated in this program held that heterosexual transmission, when it occurred, was probably due to anal intercourse, the second theory argues that heterosexual transmission may occur in cases where heterosexuals have histories of great promiscuity. The one case in which U.S. researchers presumed female-to-male transmission of HIV from a wife to a husband was in any case unique and fully consistent with Stewart's fast lane thesis. The couple participated in swinging at sexual club swaps, and over the 5 years before entry into the study, the wife had over 600 male partners, including over 2,000 contacts with a bisexual man, an unidentified number of contacts with an intravenous drug user, and over 1,000 contacts, 1,000 sexual, unprotected sex intercourse with a person she knew to be HIV positive. As part of their swinging activity, the woman would often have sex with another partner while her husband first watched, and then the husband would have intercourse with her himself. The thought might be introduced now, though, and by the way, so when all this was said, the media and the medical community were saying, see, here we have a heterosexual couple that has been infected with HIV. Well, what they failed to tell you was this woman had had 600 male partners, 2,000 different partners, and over 2,000 sexual contacts with bisexual men, and hundreds of sexual contacts with a man who was an intravenous drug user, and over 1,000 contacts with a man who she knew to be HIV positive. But they didn't put that into the story. That may have made a difference, because otherwise the media made it look like this was Betty Crocker. This was, you know, while making a doughboy for, you know, Bob and Biff and Mary and Jane, she contracted AIDS. Don't know why. That must mean all homemakers, all women, are equally susceptible. Once again, what we weren't told and what we didn't look for, the facts. The thought might be introduced now, though it is somewhat tangential to the fast-track thesis, that a number of writers, such as Albert, have it that the spread of sexually transmitted diseases and HIV because of promiscuity can hardly be partially attributable, as it has by some, to the fact that sex is unprotected. Albert's notion is that the condoms are unreliable. He says, the FDA found leakage of HIV-sized particles through 33% of condoms tested, and the overall failure rate of condoms has been estimated at between 1 and 12%. Let's think of some of the implications of the material on sexual transmission developed thus far. For one thing, it should be acknowledged that the fast lane thesis, which I presented as one response to weaknesses in the direct transmission theory, does not really solve the problems of that earlier model. If there is little or no retrovirus in the semen, assuming for this argument that HIV infection is at least one crucial component of the disease, then even drivers in the fast lane won't be in danger of contacting the virus through promiscuity. However, I presented this latter theory as a derivative merely as a way to organize this concept. In reality, the fast lane view originated independently of concerns over sexual transmission. Many who hold versions of this hypothesis, such as Duisberg, do not believe HIV is a central factor in AIDS, and so would not be bothered by the low rate of retrovirus in sperm. This is not to say, on the other hand, that the fast track lane is without flaw. Not enough research and reasoning have been done for anyone to say the fast lane theory wins hands down over all other ideas. It can also be said that the theory that AIDS can be produced by sexual transmission through anal intercourse, a theory which we saw had certain strengths, such as taking into account studies that showed passive partners are more likely to contact the disease, as well as considering the part rectal trauma may play in generating the illness, is not totally compelling either. The only certainty we have found in this section is that AIDS is not transmitted by vaginal intercourse. This is about the only subset of this whole controversy the straight media has taken cognizance of, though in doing so, getting it wrong. Let's talk about more information from the media clouds around the issue. If you've joined us just now, I'm Gary Nall. An in-depth investigative report on AIDS, Deconstructing the Myths, AIDS A Second Opinion, continues. We have seen that in the mass media, what is sensational takes precedence over what is scientifically accurate. Going further, we might say that What is sensational is what plays upon the prejudices and fears of the media's viewers and readers. When we looked at statistics projecting the future spread of AIDS, for example, we saw that the most extravagant figures were seized on without checking up on such things as whether rising estimates were based on paper manipulations. Media naivety, in this instance, it might be conjectured, was founded in its pandering to the fears of its consumers who were titillated by the dread of a new plague. But this same method of interpretation says we can imagine, and this is what happened, that any material hinting that AIDS can be passed sexually would also be sensationalistically pictured, because it plays upon many long-held prejudices of the solid middle class. Many in the middle class in America believe that teenagers having sex and general promiscuity are both bad and should be stopped in any way possible. If it were discovered, then, that a dreaded new disease was spread sexually, this would provide an opening for even more calls for the stigmatization of the sexually active and for more abstinence as a strategy to preserve health. We might even say that there would be pressure on the media to back up this prejudice by enlarging upon ideas of heterosexual transmission and downplaying material that expressed disbelief in such transmission. If we may digress a moment, step back from the data to look at the general non-permissive attitude that seems to have been ruling the airwaves for the past 20 years, we might argue that this puritanism is not an endemic characteristic of the middle class, but a historically mediated attitude. At least this is the opinion of Edward Ludwig, who in Turbo Capitalism has drawn some interesting conclusions about the connections between the general economic conditions in this country and the rise of prohibitionism. The two key economic trends that have the most impact on people's lives in the United States in, at least, let us say, the last two decades of the 20th century are shrinking wages and increasing instability in employment. To take the second point first, he says, the decisive factor is that, except for particular specialties, the U.S. labor market is chronically oversupplied in all sorts of high-skill categories. In addition to the unskilled, whose utter uselessness in a high-tech economy is by now well established. In the current lean and mean corporate environment, where an oversupply of labor exists, companies prefer to hire temps, who do not have to be given any benefits, over full-timers, to the point of firing full-timers and rehiring the same people back as casuals. Ludwig cites as a representative example a woman who has worked for Pacific Bell as a full-timer for 22 years, was fired at the time of downsizing, and then was rehired as a temp without benefits or job security. The second major long-term trend is the falling back of wages. For those in white-collar jobs, he says the more highly skilled minority has done very well. The less skilled majority has suffered an actual loss of earnings. For the lower paid service workers whose jobs have replaced those of workers in production, Ludwig found the new service economy pays less well than the old-fashioned industries in which people still make things. And for more upscale middle managers, there is a downward slide in wages of the entire population from which middle managers are drawn in the United States economy. For us, though, the key point the economist has to make is that instability of tenure in jobs and tightening of belts creates embitterment and resentment. Given that these feelings cannot be expressed in politics, with neither party much interested in the plights of the average citizen outside of election time when they all posture that they're going to do something and then don't, Ludwig surmises that these soured emotions give birth to decency crusades. Without judging the value of such calls for prohibition, he lists the confluence of demands for the ban on smoking, rich foods, types of speech, flirtation, pornography, drugs, and topless bathing. No doubt many of these, except the last, should be banned. But Ludwig point he feels. Lutwak's point is not to judge the merits of any of the demands, but to underscore the climate of banning, okay, which he sees as rooted in unexpressed, unreflected on economic grievance. It's no coincidence that prohibitions seem to multiply when the middle classes are especially insecure. In the past, a scapegoated minority would have paid the price for the declining relative incomes of most Americans, and the insecurity of many more in the brave new economy of unlimited compassion and endless structural change, which offers splendid opportunities for financial acrobatics, like well-held stock market traders, and which keeps so many Americans awake at night fearfully wondering what the morrow may bring. The unexpressed fears of insecure breadwinners, who in our society cannot persecute minorities, can find their outlet only in the prohibition of all that can be prohibited. Actually, this digression is meant to partially excuse the media for, as I've said repeatedly, my point in this discussion is not to tar this or that adversary, bad as some of them may be, but to make clear how even their destructive consequences have some logical rationale. In knowing the true grounds of different beliefs, even knowing more about these grounds than the holders of the beliefs may admit or comprehend, pernicious belief can be combated all the more strenuously. In this instance, it appears, if one holds with Lutwak, that a promotion by the media, the view that AIDS can be spread heterosexually, will often go on in the face of evidence to the contrary, in order to pander to the public's lust for anti-sex messages. The media is only too happy to do so. It profits at all levels. Let's look at a couple of instances of how the media willfully plays up shocking elements of this part of the AIDS story, even when these elements are known to be unrepresentative or altogether wrong. It's known, for example, that even if AIDS were spread heterosexually, then transmission must parallel the cases of homosexual transmission, in which it is believed that it takes up to 1,000 encounters to receive the virus. However, as Celia Farber reports in Spin, there are cases reported where a person claims to have gotten AIDS after one encounter, and these are the ones dwelt on lovingly by the mass media. It is noteworthy, she says, that those cases are so rare that we know each victim by name. She states, Allison Gertz, for instance, the young, affluent, heterosexual woman who said she caught AIDS from a man she slept with once, has graced magazine covers across the country. Suddenly, the media were making a tremendous deal out of what in reality is a very rare example, while insisting that the cases like it were the wave of the future. In 1992, to cite another example, the press went to town with the statistic that indicated HIV was to be found in one out of every 250 Americans, this being used to suggest a widespread infection through both homosexual and heterosexual channels. However, this was another example of the old mathematician's adage that untruths can be divided into lies, damn lies, and statistics. A cooler head in the media pointed out, with little effect on the general hysteria, that if you do the math, going by a population of 250 million Americans, if one out of 250 has HIV, then 1 million people, less than the previously predicted 2 million people, are infected. Reports by prestigious agencies are splashed across front pages when they provide ammunition for calls for anti-sex campaigns, but buried when they indicate the opposite. When the London paper, the Sunday Telegraph, one of the media outlets which does not run with the pack, featured a story by Ambrose Evans Pritchard on a meeting of research scientists in Washington, D.C. in December 1993, at which the participants downplayed the spread of this disease except through high-risk groups, this was barely noticed by the bulk of the mass media. The Washington meeting featured the unveiling of a study by a Dr. Gerlandine McQuillan of the National Center for Health Statistics. In it, according to Hodgkinson, were the findings of the first large random screening survey of HIV positivity in the United States. Of nearly 8,000 people tested, 29 tested positive, including just one white woman. One white woman out of 8,000 people tested. The obvious conclusion made in the study was HIV was confined to specific pockets of the population. That's according in an actual quote from the study, such as HIV drug users, particularly minorities with less access to health care and other anomalies than had users from the majority group. However, this study was not given media coverage and so could hardly deflect the funding juggernaut with dire consequences for dealing with the disease. After the study was ignored, the dogma of heterosexual AIDS went on possessing the American establishment from top to bottom. So instead of targeting funding on those at risk, the money was scattered around the country indiscriminately. Programs for sexually transmitted diseases in the inner cities, an effective way of controlling the spread of AIDS, have been gutted to pay for AIDS awareness campaigns for Mormons in Utah and Baptists in the Bible Belt. The heterosexual AIDS scare is one of the great scandals of modern journalism and modern science. That's a note that was already struck in our study when we brought up how AIDS education money has been centered on educating heterosexuals on how to avoid AIDS, which they weren't going to get, while only a trickle has been earmarked for HIV, or I should say IV drug users or homosexuals who needed the education the most. Something else wrong with this spread of misinformation is set forward by Simone, who points to the psychological and emotional toll. Natural selection has provided us with only a few ways of experiencing intense pleasure, and surely for most people, sexual intercourse is at or near the top of this short list. Hence, anything that diminishes sexual pleasure constitutes a significant cost. Yet many writers, both popular and professional, appear to assume that sex is one area of life where we should strive to reduce risk no matter what the cost. Thus, where the media and political pundits are often talking about the irresponsibility of people in spreading the disease, it seems to me it is equally just to turn the tables and ask about the irresponsibility of the media in following what it takes to be its readers' and viewers' proclivities rather than reporting the facts. And if the U.S. media has generally distorted the situation when the hot button of sexuality is pressed, imagine how it will begin to wrap its perceptions when the even more explosive topic of race lights up on the control panel. Let us begin to look at AIDS and race in Africa. In 1974, Walter Abish published the novel Alphabetical Africa, which, if it was not always as playful or iconoclastic as it purported to be, did include many scathing passages where, metaphorically, the way Westerners have viewed Africa, as they wanted to foil to their own self-conception rather than as it really was. Take the following description that appears when the hero arrives in Tanzania. Life in Tanzania is predicated upon the colored maps of Africa that hang in the palace courtesy of the National Geographic. On the maps, Tanzania is colored a bright orange. The maps are the key to our future prosperity. The maps keep everyone employed, said the queen, a European usurper of the throne, slipping into a pair of alligator boots. She then proceeded to take me on a tour in her helicopter. From an altitude of 5,000 feet, everything below, including the city, is a bright orange. Astonishingly, I thought it was the effect of the sun. No, dear boy, she patted my knee. Each day, 100,000 Tanzanians carry ladders, buckets of orange paint, and brushes, all driven and also flown to different parts of the country. They paint everything in sight. It's absurd, yet suggestive. A country is to be remade so it matches the picture in National Geographic. An imported Western expert is in charge of the recoloring of the bush. Doesn't it seem like an allegory of what took place in relation to AIDS in Africa? Scientists in the West decided on slim evidence that AIDS must be originating there, and they extrapolated. That would prove a scourge. Then they sent researchers with unreliable tests to scout out whether their suppositions were correct. Although, as the dissidents argue, evidence about the existence of AIDS was slight and contradictory, the AIDS heralds, with exaggerated statistics, poor testing, a heavy dose of racism, and other factors, managed to find what they wanted to find, just as Queen Quit is intent on making Tanzania look as she presumes National Geographic wants it to look. We can turn from literature to the criticism of literature to make another necessary point. The book Blank Darkness, African Discourse in French by Christopher Miller examines how Europeans, not just the French, despite the title, have persistently presented Africa as a country of inferiors, who, being a lower order of humans than Europeans, certainly should not object if Europeans take over their countries and economies, since their Westerners are better fitted to run them. Even the casting of blacks into slavery could be justified by these ideas, since it was claimed that slaves would be given Christianity along with their chains, and thus have their souls saved, souls that would have been lost if they had continued in primitive adultery. The belief that Africans, at least those outside of the influence of Islam in the north, were all adulterers, though from the Middle Ages to the 19th century, based largely on fantasy rather than anthropology, was central to the thesis of the continent's people's inferiority. This idolatry was presented as so casual as to be almost accidental, that is, as 16th century European authority had it, Africans are all idolaters without knowledge of God or his law. And this poor nation is so blind that the first thing encountered in the morning, be it a bird, serpent, or other animal, domestic or wild, they take it for the whole day as their god. Refusal to believe in Christianity would not be seen as such a great fault now as it did then, but the traits connected to this refusal will be fine are still being attributed to Africans when racist science is on the march. Another European so-called expert quoted by Miller draws this connection. He says the cause of idolatry is that man, through sin, left behind the contemplation of divine, invisible, and intellectual nature and sank wholly into the sense. This immersion in the senses had to be coupled with the fact that the gods were incredibly lax in restraining their worshippers. Miller states, instead of a god of authority, repression, and all-defining constancy, there is, as the European portrayed the African religion, a god-released tension, wish fulfillment, and malleability, who stands benignly to the side as his people indulge in polygamy, concubinism, and even cannibalism. There is almost a melancholy quaintness to some of the racist utterances of yesteryear, and yet, as we will see, parts of these submerged doctrines still resurface in the discussion of AIDS. Long exposed racist concepts such as that African are children of the senses who feel free to indulge in constant orgies, thus spreading AIDS unconsciously, find renewed vigor in some of the popular concepts of AIDS. Of course, scientists have not stopped and then took a look to see if they have stooped so low as to make mention of such vile remainders of racial theories. Yet in subsection of my discussion here, I will look at how some of these myths have acted as an unadmitted or unconscious background to some discussion of the supposed epidemic of AIDS in Africa, as well, especially on the conjecture that AIDS originated there. From there, we will break with the myths. Beginning in the next program, I don't believe I'll have time today, we'll examine with some of the glaring factual contradictions to the twin theories of AIDS, African origin, and the pandemic proportion there. I will move on to show that bad science and bad politics have been influential in helping promulgate the mythical views. I will end that particular segment of the program by showing some of the interest that seems to have spurred the creation of myths, as well as briefly highlight some of the tragic aftermath that has resulted from policies which have been guided by these spurious insights. Let it not be thought, though, that I have nothing positive to say in this discussion on this. No, each time a theory based on myth is exposed, I will try to add a countervailing theory. But one based on facts is an alternate hypothesis. For instance, after showing some of the fallacies involved in the idea that AIDS is of African birth, I will bring forth hard data that suggests, on the contrary, that AIDS originated in the United States or Europe and was later transported to Africa. I want to take a look at racist views as underpinning for some AIDS science. Neoconservative liberal bashers make such noise of the fact that on certain college campuses there seems to be an exaggerated concern for politically correct speech that makes it impossible for people to offer even the most innocent joke of fear it might offend a minority or other once stigmatized group. I'm not going to pass judgment on this one way or another, but rather refer to the broader issue of historical forces. We live in a civilization that for hundreds of years portrayed blacks as the despicable inferiors. The U.S. itself got much of the wealth of its primitive accumulation needed for its economic takeover from the labor power of black slaves. Once they were freed, in a civil war, by the way, begun not due to any tender feeling about the injustices of slavery, but to keep the Union from splitting apart, Afro-Americans were not welcomed into the bosom of the nation. In the South, where the majority resided, Jim Crow laws were quickly put in place, establishing an unequal system with superior whites' only facilities, from schools to graveyards, that made sure blacks didn't rise much above their former slave status. It was only with the civil rights struggles of the 1960s that Southern blacks, largely due to their own nonviolent protest, were able to abolish these laws and gain a fuller measure of equality. Mr. Liberal Basher might be willing to agree with our capsule history, but he will then insist, "Ah, Gary, all that injustice was long, long in the past. It doesn't concern us anymore." Really? Let's take another step in this argument. For hundreds of years, racist doctrine, which was not only part of popular culture, but taught in universities as a scientific discipline, pronounced that blacks were not as high on the racial pyramid as the whites because, as we learned from Miller, they were sensualists whose appetite always overbore their rationality. This was especially shown by the blacks' ungovernable sex drive. Now, our liberal bachelor laughs, such ideas are left well behind us, thrown on the ash heap with other sick fairy tales, such as those that said Orientals were all coolies or mandarins. But is he right? Our next step, we will examine a scientific hypothesis about the epidemiology of AIDS. Researchers are arguing that its spread will be greatest in Africa. Not everything is said in so many words, but it is implied that part of the basis of the theory is the fact that Africans are such sensualists that with all the horny men and women over there, it is quite likely the disease will spread like wildfire. Don't you see what a terrible pitfall for science it is on this road? Imagine there were piles of good evidence that AIDS was affecting more people and spreading much faster in Africa than elsewhere. We don't have such evidence, but imagine we did. Even if we had this backup, I would argue that it would have to be treated even more skeptically than normal scientific evidence, because the centuries of stereotypes, lies, and slanted reporting has established a proclivity towards a certain exploded view. We might put it like this by use of a metaphor. It is as if gently sloping land had deep channels cut in it from long ago, and now the work was to cut new channels, which were presently quite shallow. It would be more hope than a justified expectation to imagine current runoff would avoid the old pathways unless we constantly monitored and blocked them. This is why I would take Mr. Liberal Basher to task. He refuses to realize that no matter how free prejudice he is personally, racism is encrusted in our words and institutions. He is being feckless in saying we shouldn't have to worry about words. I don't mean that racism is inherited in our genes, but that it is often underlying a confluence of established institutions and interlinked attitudes. Take the common U.S. prejudice that power and wealth are the badges that proclaim an individual's worth. This can easily lead to racist thinking. Why? The plain fact is that power and wealth were long ago distributed so that, with token exceptions, the majority groups that obtained them then continued to hold the lion's portion. This is not to say no outsiders can ever penetrate the precedence of privilege, but that those in those upper grooves will, on the main, be those who already are born with silver, if not platinum spoons, in their baby food. The media, of course, tends to let this pass without comment. And so men like Bill Gates or Donald Trump, who have risen to great wealth, are praised as such self-made men, regardless of the fact that they came from rich families already. Trump, the son of a multimillionaire developer, and so overlooking that, it's so much easier to be self-made when, like Gates, one could go to Harvard, or like Trump, started one's career with a few million in the war chest. Now add this arrogance and this ignorance of the fact that those touted self-made heroes started from a bed of roses, to the aforementioned idea that those without wealth are losers, and you have a formula for racist thought. Our liberal basher wonders why so many WASPs are rich and so many minorities poor, drawing damaging conclusions about the minority's capabilities, while overlooking the way wealth is drawn to already established wealth. This is hardly the place to begin a psychology of prejudice, but it is necessary to insist both on how subtle influences can shape unstudied facts into the premises of racism, and how such influences still play roles, even leading roles, in the background of to our thoughts. A knowledge of this background has led R. Harrison Chermuta to say that from the earliest days of AIDS study, Western scientists have attributed its origins back to black people. First in Haiti, then in Africa, yet the scientific literature that claims to prove an African origin is full of inconsistency and sheer racist nonsense. The same author, in the essay on the volume Western Medicine as Contested Knowledge, laid out in more detail the chronology of this evolving belief, whose own continuity was thought that black people must somehow be responsible for the problem. I'm Gary Nall. Not enough time in any given hour to complete my thoughts. I will continue with exploring AIDS as second opinion, deconstructing the myths, on my next program. If you'd like a tape of today's show, call 888-317-2346. Ask for program number 12. We'll continue.